Welcome to the MRI Cast. These podcasts focus on various current topics in MRI. We invite you to ask questions via the website and even suggest topics for future MRI casts. The opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect standards in clinical practices, nor should they be considered as medical advice. Hello, I'm Bill Faulkner, and welcome to the MRI Cast. We're going to be doing a series of 7 MRI casts on the topic of gadolinium-based contrast agents, particularly peeling back the gadolinium-based contrast agents for a deeper look. Now, this 7 podcast series is sponsored by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics, and we want to thank them, and we certainly appreciate their support. This podcast is part 2 of a topic that we started with the first podcast, and the general topic is gadolinium-based contrast use in adult and pediatric neuro-MR imaging. Now, if you did not catch part 1, that's where we spent the bulk of that podcast, if not all of it, talking about pediatric neuroimaging and the use of gadolinium-based contrast agents. So now we're going to focus on adults. And with me on this podcast, again, are Kristen Harrington. Hello, Kristen.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
Doing just dandy. Can't complain. And our favorite radiologist, Dr. Howard Raleigh. How are you, sir?
I'm doing just fine, Bill. I'd never associated the word dandy with you before.
Ever since we've been, not traveling so much, I tend to dress a little differently around home. So dandy's maybe a good term. Anyway, we're going to address the use of gadolinium-based contrast agents in neuroimaging, primarily in adults. And so to kind of start with, Howard, I'd like to ask you a question. Are there any clinical indications where, gadolinium is just not needed in the adult population?
I think so, for sure. It's sort of a combination of what you think you're looking for in the case of the referring doc, and what you hope to exclude and maybe give reassurance sometimes with a low probability situation, say a headache with a normal exam, no concerning features about the type of headache, that kind of thing. Certainly a lot of spine indications are done without gadolinium for degenerative disease, root problems, et cetera, low back pain. There are lots and lots of situations where we don't need gadolinium. But I think if you step back, and I don't know my exact statistics, but at least for the brains, and we're a tertiary referral center, I'd say at least 60% of our brains are done with gadolinium. There are other situations we can talk about, like multiple sclerosis, where things have changed over time, and we use special techniques to try to still be sensitive to new lesions in that situation without necessarily giving gadolinium.
Do you think that there's any, along that line with, like you say, with multiple sclerosis, these are patients with repeat studies. As everybody knows, for the last, I don't know how many years, it seems like forever, focus has turned to gadolinium retention in the brain, which studies show, of all the areas in the body where gadolinium is retained, the least amount is retained in the brain. And then there's a lot of good studies, mostly animal studies, but other studies that show that the macrocyclic agents tend to clear out much more quickly than linear agents do. And so, Howard, do you think that's why we're seeing a big movement, I guess, if you will, to a lot of people considering using macrocyclics now more often than they would?
I think there has been a certain amount of that. If you actually look at the data, not all linears are the same. For instance, Multihance probably leaves behind much less than Omniscan, Optimark, and Magnavist. But within the macrocyclic categories, they all leave a smaller footprint. The important thing about all of this is that no one has ever shown neuronal damage or neurologic consequences of gadolinium retention, even in large amounts. And we know that it's retained in much higher amounts in liver and bone, for example, but again, without consequence. So we have to make sure that we're prudent in our limitation of gadolinium. It's all risk benefit, and there's still a very, very favorable profile for all the gadolinium agents, linear or macrocyclic, when you need them.
So, Dr. Rowley, I have a question. When you receive an order, how do you determine if it's ordered with and without contrast? How do you make the determination of how you're going to proceed forward?
Well, like a lot of other places, we have our protocol work list populated and go through those one by one. We do this as radiologists at our place to ensure that it's the right exam for the right indication. And we'll go either way, either saying, no, you don't need gadolinium for that, or no, your non-contrast exam is not going to be good for ruling out, say, CNS metastases. So we look at not only the exact protocol they requested, did they order ahead when they really wanted a pituitary, do they need contrast or not? So every single order in our shop, at least, goes under the eyes of a radiologist to fine-tune. And if there's a discrepancy between what's ordered and what's appropriate, then we'll typically try to contact the doc, or if it's urgent or if it's in our own system, we have some flexibility to change the orders, but not for outside docs or referring physicians, not for Medicare patients or prior auths. So it sort of depends on the situation, but every single order is looked at and okayed by a radiologist and fine-tuned. That's the time when you want to answer the question and get it right so that the technologist can just do the exam, hopefully without making any phone calls, and get on with it. And you know you've got the right study because you reviewed that patient's record and you fine-tuned that MR protocol.
You know, I recently received, it was either a phone call, a text, or an email.
Smoke signals.
Snapchat. I received
Morse code.
Yeah, I received. There's so many different ways to communicate. And so I just recently got a message, and it was that a facility was looking at not using gadolinium for patients with that's had a spine surgery, not necessarily using gadolinium with those patients that have had previous surgeries or fusions, for example, on their spine. Can you speak to that?
Well, you know, it depends on what the question is. And if they're just looking for sort of gross anatomy, what do the foramina look like? Is there a recurrence of central stenosis, you know, either caudequina compression or cord compression? You can do that without contrast. It also depends on the level of the spine. For example, in the lumbar spine, you get a ton of fibrosis and scar tissue that can really become problematic. And on a non-contrast lumbar spine post-op scan, you won't be able to tell the difference sometimes between scar tissue and recurrent disc. So we tend to use contrast in the lumbar spines post-op after fusions. We want to look at, hardware infection and so forth, look for enhancing collections, understand what's scar versus recurrent disc or osteophyte. In the C-spine, it's more questionable, I think, or controversial. We still, for complicated cases, will give contrast. But in the C-spine and T-spine, there's a lot less of that sort of fibrosis. You can make a judgment depending on what the question is, whether you really need contrast or not. But the default for lumbar, at least in our shop, is that you give contrast.
And you know, this question was specifically about cervical, and I think it does make sense completely about the lumbar.
Let me ask a question. When you were talking through that, Howard, you mentioned, you know, the post-operative spine, and it came to mind about protocol. And I bet I know what you do. Well, maybe I don't know what you do. Actually, I don't. You know, a lot of sites, they'll struggle with, you know, do you use fat sat or not use fat sat? And then I've talked to a lot of sites go, well, our problem is we got some doctors that want it, some that don't. So they wind up doing a buttload of sequences after, one with fat sat, one without fat sat. One of the techniques that has been around actually for a long time, and there's multiple techniques now, based off the so-called Dixon technique. And I know that the IDEAL technique was developed at your shop up there in Madison. And so I'm curious about, you know, if it were me and I had my choice on a protocol, if you do the sagittal T1 sequence after GAD, but you do it with the a Dixon-based technique, you actually get 2-for-1, or you get more than that, but you get a standard image, and then you would also get a water-only image, which then by definition would be fat-suppressed. What do y'all do at your place? Do you do that?
Well, in general, for most of the spines, we're starting with SAG T1, T2 without FatSat, and then a T2 stir. That's really very durable, even in cases of some susceptibility artifacts, say from fusion hardware. If it's a terrible, metal everywhere, rods everywhere, we may even use a single shot fast spin echo without FatSat just to try to reduce that metal artifact. We also get, in most cases, post-op spines will get a dedicated pre-contrast axial T1 and T2, of course, without FatSat, and then get the identical sequence post-contrast. So on the axials, we get a sagittal T1 post-contrast with FatSat. And depends on the area, we have different techniques, including Dixon, but most typically we're doing that with a ChemSat type standard approach. It's sort of balancing time and flexibility.
You know, with regard to, back to the brain for a second, since we got talking about pulse sequences and such, what would you say is your standard go-to pulse sequence selection if you're doing a just a routine brain with and without, not so much non-complicated, I guess.
Okay. Well, we would call that our comprehensive brain. We would start with a SAG T1, and that's a multi-slice, although for some applications, I think you've suggested this, Bill, sometimes a SAG T1 volume is nice, so you can recon that later. We do a multi-slice at the moment, then axial T2 with FatSat. We like FatSat to look at the scalp, calvarium, skull base, the orbits. We typically get a gradient echo T2 star diffusion with standard B value of 1000. And depending on the protocol, we'll usually get an axial T1 gradient echo. And we get that at 2.4 millimeters. It's good enough. If you have to, you could recon it, but we get that because we're going to do a post-contrast gradient echo. We want to be able to compare the same exact type of tissue contrast sequence to sequence. Post-contrast is a sagittal T1 3D volume, like space or cube, followed by an axial gradient echo at 1.0 or 1.2 millimeters to be used for neuronavigation. Or treatment planning and radiation if needed. And finally, we end up with a coronal T1 FatSat done with a cube or T1 spin echo type sequence. So we get three post-contrast volumes that help us tease out anything, scan once, recon many. And that T2 flare done only post-contrast gives us a spacer to optimize the post-contrast delay so that those T1s give us maximal enhancement for the majority of lesions.
You know, I just had a question, and you may do this, but this is just a question about the T2 star. Do you choose just a regular 2D T2 star over an SWI, or are you talking about an SWI type of sequence pre-contrast?
So the pre-contrast, we have three options for that, and it just sort of depends on the protocol and how fast you want to go. The SWI or SWAN type sequence runs something like 3 to 5 minutes, depending on how you've set that up, and it is sort of the most rigorous way in most places to look at susceptibility for blood or calcium. Mm-hmm. But it takes twice as long as just a conventional 2D GRE, which is usually adequate, which is what we use for our standard protocols, is just a 2D. We also have a fast echo planar gradient echo sequence that we call our pseudo SWAN. It's a two-shot gradient echo EPI. It's very heavily T2 star weighted. In fact, at least as heavily T2 star weighted as the SWI or SWAN sequences. And that takes only about 25 seconds to acquire, but he has the downside of pretty frequent phase artifacts, banding AP artifacts. So you have to read through those and get used to it. But we use that one for a lot of our FAST protocols. We have a family of FAST contrast or non-contrast protocols for brain or stroke work. And that's where we pull out that pseudo SWAN, super fast one.
You know, I think that's a good thing to note because I have not heard about that being done in the field. So I think it's a good thing for people to hear.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other option you have for T2 star imaging, if you're using a perfusion sequence, which is going to be typically a gradient echo EPI, the pre-contrast baseline images are really good for that. And the group at Stanford has shown that they're just as good as a dedicated gradient echo T2 star. And some of the software packages, like, for example, the rapid software package for stroke imaging, actually puts a column view of all the parameter maps for perfusion, but also gives you the pre-contrast baseline, which if you're going to do that, you don't even need to include a dedicated gradient echo because you're going to get it out of the perfusion series.
So the Stanford group, so make sure I understand it right there, showed that the B0, not the B0 diffusion, are you saying, did you say the...
Nope. So the B0, which is the diffusion-weighted parent of the diffusion-weighted MRI, that's an echo planar spin echo image. Yeah. That has some T2 star in it, but not nearly as much as a gradient echo EPI. And gradient echo EPI is what you're using to capture dynamic susceptibility contrast perfusion, the wash-in and wash-out. And so that one's really good for detecting blood. It's lower resolution than we'd be getting with SWI, SWAN, or conventional gradient echo, but it's good enough to exclude blood and to characterize calcification or mineralization.
Okay, I'm sorry, I just totally misunderstood that then. But on that same token though, that's another good reason to be doing perfusion a lot more. I know in the pediatric podcast, we spoke to that a fair amount. And, for those that haven't listened to that one, our point was that perfusion using gadolinium-based contrast agents is really underutilized. It can give you a lot of information, and it's not all just about stroke. Stroke is one reason to do it, right?
That's absolutely right. And, we've sort of been learning more about perfusion since it's now advanced imaging like perfusion is required for selecting some stroke patients for thrombectomy, at least in the late time windows. And so we're learning from that and getting used to seeing these scans. And we have a very low threshold for adding perfusion, especially in somebody who's already getting contrast. It's just another sequence that runs about a minute or so and gives you a lot of information for that short amount of time.
To that point, you're giving the GAD anyway. Why not just use it? It's what I've always found funny. And we talked a little bit about off-label use, but if I still understand it correctly, using gadolinium for stroke or tumor imaging, in the brain is certainly a labeled indication. But perfusion imaging, is that still correct that that's the use of gadolinium for perfusion would still be technically considered off-label?
That's right. Technically, that is off-label. The companies didn't ask for that indication when they applied for their gadolinium approvals. But that doesn't mean it's inappropriate or wrong. It's just that it's not on-label. And there are scores and scores, hundreds, thousands of papers attesting to the utility of perfusion in a range of abnormalities, especially stroke, but also in the area of tumor diagnosis and follow-up.
I just find it humorous that it's like you can give the gadolinium and you can look at it, it gets there, but if you watch it while it goes through, that's off-label. It's almost like no peeking, got to wait till it gets there.
Right. I still think there's a great amount of apprehension surrounding perfusion. And I think that's one of the main, root causes of why it's not utilized.
What do you think people are apprehensive of?
You know, I think the more you use it, like any other technique, the more you get used to the pitfalls, the artifacts, et cetera, because, you know, it's not trivial. And there are a lot of different parameters that can be produced, these color parameter maps. People are a little scared when they wade into it. But I think now that so many packages are available that automatically make beautiful color maps that are quantitative or at least semi-quantitative, and we're using those in our stroke patients, people are going to get more comfortable with it. And I think we'll see it used more and more. It gives you physiology, you know, over just the anatomy we're looking at typically with our magnitude images in a routine protocol.
So Howard, if you don't mind me asking, can you give us an overview of your stroke or various stroke protocols that you do at your facility?
Oh, sure enough. We look at those as sort of a stroke plus. You know, we want to get everything that's in the differential for a brain attack. So we want to go fast so we can make decisions for IVTPA or for thrombectomy with catheters. But we also want to get all the other diagnoses, because in a large pool of patients, you're only going to have maybe 10% who are thrombectomy candidates, depending on how you're screening them. So that comes to our protocols. Most of the patients who are thought to have a large vessel occlusion clinically go to CT, and they get a CT, a CTA, and a CT perfusion. But there are certain circumstances where we specifically want to go to MR either first or as a rapid follow-up. And those situations are in pediatrics, where we want to avoid the CT radiation. Also in patients who might be a late arrival or a wake-up stroke or a stroke of unknown onset, where we want to look at diffusion and flare to try to gauge how old the infarct is and consider IVTPA right away. We also use MR for posterior fossa or brainstem strokes, for example. And we'll use it as a follow-up if there's ongoing strong suspicion after a negative CT protocol. Maybe we missed a small lacune or something that would be hard to pick up. So we've traditionally had very comprehensive stroke protocols. Lately, just in the last year, we've been really pushing out what we call our fast stroke protocols that I can talk about if you want to hear about it.
Yeah, that would be the one that interests me. Pretty much anybody can do a comprehensive protocol. Not being disrespectful there, but something that's tailored and fast. That's what I'd like to hear about.
All righty. So we actually sort of label these with the acronym FAST. It's all caps, all capital letters, FAST, Fast Abbreviated Survey Technique.
And fancy acronyms.
Very fast. Don't be acrimonious, please. And really, these are 6 to 10 minute protocols for stroke that include some very fast MR sequences as well as MRA, MRV. And they can be done either without contrast for a low suspicion case or with contrast, which is really our default. And so maybe I'll describe the with contrast, since that's the one we're using the most. We will start with a sagittal T1. We use a volume, actually, a T1 cube, but it's a coarse one. It's about 5 millimeter slices, takes about 25 seconds or so. We then get a diffusion-weighted scan, which gives us the B0, B1000, and we make a synthetic high B value at 2500. Next, we inject, and we get dynamic susceptibility perfusion imaging. And so in the first couple of minutes, we've got diffusion and perfusion. We send that to the software package that makes our parameter maps and mismatch maps. So that's, in our case, we use RAPID, which is the one that was used in all the randomized clinical trials. And that starts cooking, and it's going to come back with images in 3 minutes. Now, during that 3 minutes, we get everything else post-GAD. We get a axial pseudo-SWAN, that gradient echo EPI. We get a single-shot fast spin echo T2. We grab a T2 flare. And, the T2 flare is to rule out subarachnoid hemorrhage. The T2 star is to rule out a parenchymal hemorrhage. And we then get, this is sort of the magic sauce for our protocol. We get a 3D EPC, a phase contrast MRV, MRA with a velocity encoding of 40 or 50 that gets you all the major arteries, all the major veins. You open up the SI coverage, so you've got intracranial and down to the carotid bifurcations. So you screen everything in about 2 minutes. That also gives you not only, you know, from the phase images, the vasculature, but also gives you magnitude images, which are nominally T1 weighted. So you can do all of that, including all the contrast and everything, in about 10 minutes. And by the time they roll out of the magnet, you've already got your diffusion, perfusion, mismatch maps. You also have flare and diffusion, so you can see if they're a candidate on wake-up stroke, you know, trial basis for IV tPA. And you've ruled out arterial and venous occlusions, at least major ones. So it's a very, very slick way to evaluate stroke. But with that protocol, you'll also get stroke mimics like tumors, infection, et cetera. So that's become an extremely useful protocol for us. And in the times of COVID, it's really nice, you know, to be able to move people in and out quickly, reducing bidirectional exposure for techs and for patients in the imaging facility, squeeze in a few more cases a day as well.
So you're really only doing three series pre-contrast, right? I was kind of trying to make some notes here listening. So the thick slab, the sagittal, the diffusion,
T1.
Yeah, the thick slab T1.
And then diffusion.
And then inject.
I did misspeak. I do one more pre-contrast with this version, and that's a single slab MRA using HyperSense. It takes only about 50 seconds, so you get the circle of Willis in there. So it's a Sag T1, an axial 3D time of flight with HyperSense diffusion, and then the gradient echo EPI perfusion series.
Okay.
And then everything else goes post-CAD. And by the way, we're only using a 12 ml of multi-Hansen in this protocol. Mm-hmm. And that's because we're checking these to see if we need to convert to a more complete exam, say using a neck Trix. And so we can do that with the other 8 ml that we might give for an adult. So it's a smaller dose of gadolinium, yet you get all the information from perfusion and post-contrast images out of it.
So is that what you might refer to as splitting a dose of GAD?
Yes, it gives you the potential to split the dose. Sometimes we don't end up giving that second part of the dose because it may not be necessary. With multi-Hansen, you'll recall it has sort of doubled the relaxivity of most of the other agents. So giving a 12 out of 20 mLs, you're giving a 60% dose, and that would enhance lesions better than a single dose of the other traditional agents that might be available on the market.
Is that also considered a fractional dose, or is that something different?
Yes, that's fractional dose, so it would be off-label. But you know, the thing about dynamic sequences like perfusion or time-resolved MRA, as the ACR reminds us, you use the lowest dose you need to get the information you want. And so if you can do that with a 60% dose, why not? Or a 40% dose in the case of a twist or a Trix or treat or, you know, one of the time-resolved MRAs that you might be using for your arch neck imaging.
Well, I think a lot of people don't think of it this way. But over the years, in conferences, I've had the privilege of working with you and Dr. Jeff Mackey. You know, what I've found out is the amount of gadolinium, volume of GAD, if you were going to give, particularly for a lot of these super fast MRA sequences, really is more technically related. In other words, how fast is your acquisition? Because the quicker the acquisition, the less GAD you actually need.
That's right. And it turns out for these dynamic acquisitions, at least if you're, say, just dealing with the adult population, which is the vast majority of these stroke workups, you're better off having a fixed protocol with a fixed volume because and flush and timing and so forth, because you've optimized your MRA and your perfusion sequences to that. And so it's actually, you know, better than trying to customize each one. We just give a standard 12 ml for the perfusion. If we want tricks, we use 8, and they're injected at the same way every time. And, you know, we cap our doses at 20 mLs for adults because we're using multi-hands. That would get you up to a, you know, a 440-pound patient equivalent if you're using a single dose of any of the other agents. And it's hard to get somebody at 440 even into the magnet. So we split and we cap at 20.
Wow, that's interesting. But, you know, that kind of makes sense. You know, the other thing, going back before the days of high relaxivity, we would always have this discussion, particularly when we had a low field magnet. It's like, well, do you stop at 20? Do you go on up and do, you know, really do weight-based dosing? And, you know, again, so you've got somebody that's 350 pounds. So, you know, by weight-based dosing, they'd be on up into the 30-something cc's. But I remember having a discussion with Dr. Canal, Manny Canal, about this. And, you know, he said above a certain weight, it really doesn't matter because everybody's got the same blood volume, you know, regardless of, you know, how big you are. And you also have essentially the same extracellular fluid space. All you do is you're adding fat, which, you know, really doesn't have anything to do with the distribution. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's the same kind of thinking that goes through for, say, dialysis professionals. You're doing this based more on lean body mass and extracellular volume rather than fat, which really doesn't count. But it sure shows up on the scale.
I like to hear it said, fat does not count. I really like to hear that.
In this context, oh. Bill, please. So, yeah, I think that the curve is not linear as you get up into these, you know, these Wisconsinites that I see every day, including myself.
So, Howard, I have a question. And when Bill and I do courses together, we get a lot of questions about checking the EGFR on patients. And according to the ACR guidance and the FDA as well, what do you see out there? And what do you recommend?
Well, that's a great question. And it's a little bit controversial because the FDA on label says that you need to check renal function and EGFRs before giving any of the gadolinium agents. That's something that came up, of course, in the context of nephrogenic systemic fibrosis. But the ACR has reviewed this in great detail, and I'd refer you to their recent contrast media manual. They say that if you're using a group one agent or group three agent, so group one would be some of the traditional agents like Omniscan, Magnavist, Optimark, and group three would be Eovist, that they say you should still check renal function. If you're using the other agents in group two, which would be your macrocyclics, Prohance, Doterum, Clariscan, Gadivist, and the linear agent Multihance, those have so few cases, even at high risk for NSF, that they say you do not need to check renal function if you're using a group two agent. So I think a lot of the practices have gone to group two agents for general imaging and neuro in particular. Eovist looks like it's going to join group two eventually because it seems to be quite safe. But for the moment, it's still a group three. And we still hand out the medication guide as required by the FDA. And it says your renal function will be checked. So we're a little bit in the middle here between the FDA and the ACR, but we follow the ACR guidance on this and we don't check renal function for group two agents. We pay attention if we know there's acute kidney injury or something like that. If they're a hemodialysis patient, we try to coordinate dialysis soon after the injection, but we don't check renal function anymore because we use exclusively group two agents for general imaging.
Oh, and just one little follow-up to that, and you can answer this quickly. We get a lot of questions about the medication guide and what we recommend is, you know, one time for outpatients, and they typically don't give that out to inpatients. How do you handle that there?
We do give it in exactly the same way you just described. We have it available for inpatients or their families. And what we've done is we've printed up sort of an overview of your MRI exam on the front side and the medication guide on the backside of a single paper, either digitally or on actual paper. And that puts the gadolinium in the context of the exam. And we get very, very few questions on that at this point. We were concerned this would create a big disturbance, a lot of people refusing and so forth. But at least for us, it's pretty much been a non-issue, especially when you place it in the risk-benefit context of the exam.
Well, you know, it's kind of an interesting one that actually two things came to mind here as we kind of wrap this up. Number one, there's a lot less emphasis on gadolinium retention in the brain in the lay press anymore. You really just don't see it anymore. And in fact, there was an article, I saw it referenced on AntMini. And this article was, and I apologize, I can't remember from what institution it originated, but they did some sort of a survey on social media and of the patients that were people that were discussing an MRI exam and, you know, with contrast, that really a very small percentage, less 10, right at 10% or less, even mentioned gadolinium retention. And at least what I'm hearing out there is that's just not really in everybody's front of everybody's attention anymore. And the other thing that I find interesting, with the introduction of Clariscan, the same chemical as in Dotarem, and this was, if I'm not mistaken, this got FDA approval November of 19, I believe. So it's been, you know, out now for a while, and I haven't checked because I don't buy gadolinium. But if you take a look at the Group 1 agents, Optimark hasn't been on the market for at least 2 years, maybe more. Magnavis has stopped being marketed in the U.S. as of fall of 2019, I believe. And then the only Group 1 agent left is OmniScan. But if you've got, I'm assuming the same company that sells OmniScan selling Clariscan, I'm assuming you wouldn't be making OmniScan anymore because you've got this macrocyclic agent. So in reality, there's little to no use, I would expect, of Group 1 agents.
Well, there are a lot of reasons why you still want to have at least a couple agents on the shelf. For example, if somebody has a documented reaction to one agent, you might want to be able to use another one. I think there are some, or at least one good-sized paper that suggests that there may be fewer acute adverse events with OmniScan, one of our old Group 1 agents, than with some of the other agents, although that hasn't been verified in all studies. I think one of the issues that you mentioned, though, is the awareness of not only NSF, but also especially gadolinium retention. There are some groups of people who and patient groups that are especially aware of this. And for example, in our practice, the MS patients, multiple sclerosis patients, are really on top of things in terms of being aware of gadolinium retention. And a lot of those exams have gone toward non-contrast. And so what we've done in our shop, we honor that if they don't want to get contrast, but we use a T2 flare volume, and we use a subtraction technique so that we can better assess what's new, what's old, et cetera, to look for signs of disease activity without giving the gadolinium. I still prefer to give gadolinium if there's a concern about a new lesion or a new deficit, even in the MS patients, even if they're getting gadolinium over the years, because I don't think there's a big effect of gadolinium retention on neurologic consequences. But we do have other ways to get the same sort of information with volumetric subtraction.
Well, that's a kind of a good way, I believe, to just wrap up this wide-ranging discussion on the use of gadolinium-based contrast agent. Again, this series of podcasts is being brought to you by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics. Again, we thank them for this and for their support. Thanks to Kristen. Thanks to Howard. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Howard, and then thank you, Bill.
Thank you, fearless leader, Bill, and fearless partner, Kristen.
Thank you.
And we're done, so you'll just have to get over it. We'll talk to you on the next MRI Cast. You've been listening to MRI Cast, produced by William Faulkner & Associates and Northwest Imaging Forums.